Hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
We can't have unscrupulous operators, for example, cutting corners or making decisions that adversely impact the quality or safety in a centre in attempt to maximise their shareholder dividend.
Federal and state education ministers have announced a suite of reforms aimed at strengthening child safety in early childhood education also.
Obviously, we've all just been through COVID-19. It's very, very likely, I hate to say this, but we will in the future get another pandemic of something. Absolutely obvious.
Last week, an academic and his team were recognised for their outstanding work at the 2025 GSK Awards for Research Excellence in Virology. And later today...
That people, the level of homelessness, the level of people living in cars, the people who can't afford to turn on a heater.
We speak with knitting and crochet not-for-profit Wrap for Love, sending thousands of volunteer-crafted blankets to those in need. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, a new push to place restrictions on abortion access in South Australia is set to be introduced to Parliament by Upper House MP Sarah Game. The former One Nation turned independent MP will introduce a bill to place new limits on abortions after 23 weeks. Ms. Game plans to bring the bill to a vote before the March 2026 state election. This comes less than a year after the last debate over the state's pregnancy termination laws. South Australian GPs are among those speaking out against the new proposed restrictions. To hear more, I spoke to Royal Australian College of GPs Deputy South Australia Chair, Dr. Claire Keogh.
But it's really few and far between when it comes to abortion care. So late-term abortions after 23 weeks, quite unusual or quite rare in their occurrence, and done in conjunction, obviously, with the doctor and the patient. There's a very rigorous process involved in that, and it's not something that is done without, you know, significant discussion. It's usually a very complex situation and very personal.
What are the risks in politicising reproductive healthcare in these ways, especially with similar bills or bills like these that really don't recognise the complexity of the situation?
Yeah, I think, South Australia is in a wonderful position where we decriminalised abortion back in 2021. And that really put the power back in the hands of, you know, pregnant people, whether they're women or people that have a uterus. And that is really where it should be, between that person who makes the decision in an informed way and their doctor or their group of, healthcare practitioners. By politicising it, it really undermines that relationship between practitioner and patient and undermines that really complex decision that's already taken a lot of time and effort to come to. Really, we want the safety for all people. You know, abortion care is healthcare. Without it, there would be a lot of harm done. So it is very important to keep it legal and to keep it accessible.
So in contrast to the bill, earlier this year, health organisations among RACGP called for strengthening access to abortion and related services. What are the gaps currently, and what does strengthening access to these services look like?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I think obviously the legal framework needs to be there, and it currently is there. So that's why we're pushing against any further restrictions. In terms of access, really, it comes down to the normal things like, basically capacity of services that already exist. We have quite a lot of public services, you know, primarily the Pregnancy Advisory Centre here in South Australia, but there are other locations and other health networks, but they're at capacity. So, you know, it is now legal and accessible for all GPs to prescribe for medical terminations on the PBS, but some of the education isn't there. And obviously, as a practitioner, you want to feel safe and comfortable providing that service. So, you know, between RACGP and other organisations, including Shine SA, whom I also work for and I'm also a representative for, we're looking to continue to upskill doctors in order to provide the service, but Of course, it all takes time and funding. So we're very pleased that the government has committed to improving funding for reproductive health so we can continue to educate people.
Unlikely that this bill is passed, but obviously, you know, we have to acknowledge the fact that it's been raised as legitimate.
Yes.
But what are the real health risks if we do take a step back in the grand scheme of women's reproductive health?
So I think, you know, the other recent restrictive bill that was proposed, the Ben Hood bill, was only narrowly defeated. So we have to be mindful of the fact that, you know, there is ongoing political commentary on this and it is a stigmatized issue. The risk really is around safety for people who are pregnant. You know, the reasons for an abortion are personal and complex, and certainly there are plenty of medical reasons and mental health reasons, but there are also a lot of complex social reasons, including, you know, family and domestic intimate partner violence. Realistically, this decision should not be made by politicians who don't have oversight into that. It needs to be made on an individual basis between doctor and patient. It's a similar argument to, you know, teaching abstinence instead of sexual education. You know, people will continue to have abortions. It is part of healthcare. Criminalizing it just creates more of a barrier and makes it more unsafe. So being decriminalized is excellent. We need to continue to have it decriminalized and unrestricted, you know, within the parameters of safety, obviously, for the patient, so that there is no barrier. Because as soon as you put in barriers, you just create an unsafe environment.
Dr. Claire Keogh from RACGP there, ending that report.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Federal and state education ministers have announced a suite of reforms aimed at strengthening child safety in early childhood education. The reforms include a national register of staff, a ban on personal mobile phones, and mandatory training to detect and report grooming and abuse. The Independent Education Union of Australia in New South Wales and ACT have welcomed the reforms, but say more must be done to reduce excessive paperwork and address the sector's staff retention crisis. The Wire's Azucena Carrasco spoke with Federal Secretary of Independent Education Union Australia, Brad Hayes, to unpack what these reforms mean for teachers, centres and families.
Look, it was a really important week last week in terms of the early childhood education reform agenda, and these are proposed to be rolled out nationally. So they were announced by the federal government, but that was in consultation and collaboration with the education ministers of all other states and territories. And look, we think our members are telling us, and what we're hearing on the ground is that these will be, you know, a very positive step towards, you know, greater safety in the childcare sector. There's a number of really important protections. You know, initiatives like a national staff register for workers in early childhood education, and also a requirement for mandatory training for early childhood education staff. They're really important. And, you know, in that area of mandatory training, what we really need to see happen, and we're pleased that this has been supported by the reforms, is that the management and owners of early childhood education services also need to undertake that training. And you know, those types of reforms and protections in terms of child safety have existed for, you know, decades in schools. And, you know, this just brings childcare providers into line with what's accepted and standard practice in the school sector. And, you know, it's not before time. All children, students and staff in education deserve to be safe. And that should apply whether they're in childcare, you know, a kindergarten, a preschool or school. So, yes, we support the changes and we think they're long overdue.
The union raised concerns about the excessive paperwork that is a burden on educators. Can you explain how this impacts the teacher's ability to focus on children and what changes you would like to see?
Yeah, well, like all areas of education, teacher workload and teacher burnout is a huge problem. And it's a problem in early childhood education just as it is in schools, unfortunately. You know, it leads to really high rates of staff turnover. not just employees taking a break from working in early childhood education, but employees and teachers leaving the sector altogether, and we're losing that wealth of experience and knowledge of those workers. Administrative paperwork is probably the biggest cause of that workload and burnout. Too often our members in early childhood education, especially teachers and directors, are caught up in this kind of, this never-ending cycle of paperwork. And much of this paperwork is duplicative. You know, teachers are filling out the same form after another, over and over again. And what we're saying to employers and government is that work needs to be streamlined and simplified, because it's a huge driver of teacher workload. And this kind of excessive and, as I said, work that often is duplicated across centres eats into the valuable education planning and professional development time that staff can attend to. You know, there's only so many hours in a day, and there's only so many hours in a week.
Mm-hmm. Understandably, there was a mention of the installation of CCTV cameras, but these cannot be installed in every room, for example, in toilets. What is the meaning of genuine safety culture, and how does it look in practice?
Yeah, it was interesting to note that the reforms announced last week that the CCTV trial of cameras in centres seemed to get the most attention through the media, but we've got to remind everyone that that's just a very small part of the solution to safer childcare services. So, look, they will help. CCTV cameras will help in certain scenarios, but they're just one part of the broader changes needed to build a more overarching culture of safety. Because, and this has been highlighted by our union in many, submissions and discussions with government around the early childhood education sector, there can be a tension in profit-driven workplaces, and the majority of early childhood education is now provided by commercial operators. We need quality and safety to win out every time in terms of that tension. We can't have unscrupulous operators, for example, cutting corners or making decisions that adversely impact the quality or safety in a centre in attempt to maximise their shareholder dividends.
And one of the problems that you have mentioned before, and the union has been raising for some time, is the pay parity with school teachers. And that brings the difficulty to attract and retain childhood teachers. So do you see a pay increment happening in the near future?
Yes, well, hopefully there's a pay increment happening soon, but the reality is the education workforce in the early childhood education sector is it's really diverse. Look, there are some green shoots, though, in this area. The new collective bargaining laws introduced by the federal Labor government are helping, and rates are on the increase thanks to more union agreements, but there's still, a lot of work to do to improve wages and conditions across what's a really diverse and fragmented early childhood education sector.
Brad Hayes from IEUA there, speaking with The Wire's Azucena Carrasco. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM. To our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. Last week, an academic and his team were recognised for their outstanding work at the 2025 GSK Awards for Research Excellence in Virology. Professor of Virology at the University of Sydney, Eddie Holmes, and his team were the first research group to publicly release the genomic sequence of the virus causing COVID-19, enabling a collaboration network worldwide. Professor Holmes' team is obtaining gene analysis with AI to better understand how infectious disease epidemics emerge. To speak more about his work in virology, The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Professor Holmes.
It's a really good, obviously, a great thing to happen. It's a kind of reward for my kind of team and collaborators over many years that have tried to use genomic sequence data to try and better diagnose infectious disease. So it's kind of, hopefully, it's a recognition of our past work. And for the future, it will allow us to do this in a more efficient way.
Well, congratulations. Now, could you please tell us a little bit more about the work that has led you to win this recognition?
So if you can, obviously, we'll remember the COVID-19 pandemic. So I was involved in the kind of earliest sequencing of the virus. Now, how that happened, it's important to understand this because this is what I'm doing, and this award is I'm doing in the future. So what happened, if you remember back to Wuhan, my colleagues in China had some patients who were working in Wuhan, and they managed to take a sample from the lung, like you put a tube down, you get what's called a lung wash sample. It's a lung sample. And these patients had this new mysterious respiratory disease. What they then did was called metagenomic sequencing. So what you do is you take that sample and you sequence all the DNA in the RNA, all genetic material in that sample, and use computers to work out what those bits of DNA are. And mostly it's human, but in there is also bacteria and viruses and whatever. Now, in the case of this particular person from Wuhan, we found really high levels of a new coronavirus, and that became SARS-CoV-2, the cause of COVID-19. So that's the technique. The problem is, or the good thing is in the same time, is you generate so much data, it's quite difficult to analyze. So every time we do this, we produce about the same amount of data as 10 complete human genomes. So what you need are good computers to analyze that data.
Well, you know, with artificial intelligence in full swing in different sectors and working for the industry as well, can you please explain a little bit more on how has it helped you in your research to understand viruses better?
Yeah, so, I mean, people get quite nervous when they hear AI, okay, because it conjures up kind of images of kind of, you know, subversive images. What it really is, though, is it's a very clever computer algorithm, okay? And a better word, actually, than AI is machine learning, because that's all it is. So what all you do is the computer program, the algorithm, is trained on some data, okay? So you train it to recognize patterns, and it's very, very efficient at recognizing patterns in data. So what we do in our particular case is this. We have this huge amount of genomic sequence data, and we train the computer to recognize a pathogen, okay? So we give it some data. We say, okay, we're going to train you to recognize the signature of the pathogen in that genomic data. Once you've trained it, you can then allow it to look at real data. And the power of this technique is just much quicker and more efficient than the other computer programs.
Now, what do you see as the next breakthrough in the field of virology?
So virology is a very big discipline. I think there are a number of things we need to think about. One, obviously, we've all been through COVID-19. It's very, very likely, I hate to say this, but we will in the future get another pandemic of something. It's absolutely obvious. The way humans live today, move around the world and pass viruses on just allows that to happen. So what we need to do is have good screening of new pathogens, and virology is kind of key to that. The second thing I think is that many people have chronic diseases. You can think of things like multiple sclerosis, for example. And if there's some evidence now that maybe viruses are playing a role in somebody's long-term chronic infections, we didn't realize that they may have a viral cause, but maybe they do.
Now, my last question, in which way is this recognition helping you in your research? And what's the future work in what you're doing?
The plan is to really now get a diagnostic technique that's going to work within 24 hours. Now, what's important is this. Some people, there are some diseases, we still don't know what the exact cause is. So a very common one is encephalitis or brain inflammation. But half the cases globally, we don't know what the cause of that encephalitis is. And so what my technique is going to help is try and find that cause.
Professor Eddie Holmes from the University of Sydney there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
A volunteer knitting and crochet not-for-profit says although the seasons have changed, the need for a warm blanket remains. Wrap with Love is currently preparing to send thousands of wraps to those in need in Laos and Syria, while hundreds of volunteers are also responding to the needs of local communities around Australia. Speaking to National Radio News' Shannon Kirkwood, Chair of Rap with Love, Alexis Lander explains how volunteers are responding to the ongoing need in the domestic and international community.
And RAPS is our word for a blanket, and it came from being able to wrap yourself and keep yourself warm so you're wrapped with love. And we work with all manner of organisation, charities, not-for-profits, community organisations, various hospitals, community corrections, women's refuges. And the projects, I suppose you could say, are the packing and getting ready for those organisations to come and take the wraps. So at the moment, we're packing 3,000 wraps that they're coming to pick up to send to Laos in about 2-3 weeks. We're packing another 2,000 that at the end of September they're sending, an organisation is sending to Syria.
And so, Alexis, with winter having now, I guess, it's still a bit chilly in Bathurst, I will say, but have you had quite a few more requests? Do you find that that's more demand during winter? Is that when you are kind of at your busiest there?
We are. However, the funny thing you'll find is that people will say, look, it's really hot and that, but at night it gets quite cold or quite cool. And then there'll be organisations that come that are handing out wraps to homeless people. So it may lessen off over the summer months, but the demand in the last couple of years through winter has been huge. There are an enormous number of people who can't afford heating, who can't pay for heating. There are an increased number of people that are homeless or living in cars. And so far this year, we've probably, without this 2,000 and 3,000 that are going out at the end of the month, we've probably already distributed about 12,000-13,000. So by the end of the month, it will be near 16,000-17,000 wraps already this year.
How does it work? What role do volunteers play in this, in your work?
Well, we have two lots of volunteers. One are the volunteers who work in the warehouse. They register everything that comes into the warehouse. They pack, they sort them, they pack them. And there's quite a bit of work around that. And then we have people really across Australia, mainly up and down the eastern seaboard. But we have people in Darwin. We have people in South Australia and the Victorians who are members of knitting groups in retirement villages, in libraries, community halls, church halls, and they knit away, and they either knit squares or a full wrap and then get them to us in our warehouse in Alexandria, and then we do the sorting and packing and sending out. So there are several thousand people.
Does it surprise you year on year how much there is a need for wraps?
I get surprised. I can't say I get very depressed, but I get angry. I get very angry in myself, not for anybody else, but in a country that really has this amount of wealth, that people, the level of homelessness, the level of people in living in cars, the people who can't afford to turn on a heater. So, you know, I get very angry that we live it. But by the same token, I'm absolutely delighted that we, in our very small way, can make a contribution and in this way. So, for example, I heard about a presentation of a principal from a school in Western Sydney in a low socioeconomic area. And she was talking about how the school provides meals and how the school has showers and washing machines and this sort of thing, and for the children and for the parents if they need it. So this year we gave her wraps for every child in the school, in the primary school, by the same token as giving them an absolutely delighted, but that the need all the time is just getting bigger and bigger.
That was Alexis Lander from Rap with Love there, speaking with National Radio News' Shannon Kirkwood. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries on which this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.